G'day everyone, and welcome to A Place to Call Home podcast. On today's episode, we chat to Tim from The Food Farm, and it was such a cracking conversation. I think I kept on talking for another 20 minutes and hitting Tim with questions after we pressed the stop record button. So thank you very much, Tim, for all your patience and answering all my questions, but it was an absolute cracker and I got so much out of this conversation. The Food Farm is a paddock to plate business, and they service right along the East Coast there. And honestly, it's incredible what Tim has done from building, from he started off doing a bit of boxed beef in the early days, going into pasture-raised chooks and eggs. And then now he runs an incredible team down there. And he is making some incredible revenue off this business model. Very high, very successful, and it's awesome to hear. And one little secret I suppose I'll let out pretty quick is that he doesn't actually own any country. So he's running this business on lease country, and which is an awesome story and an awesome for us, I suppose, wanting to chase that journey one day, owning a place to call home, that we can see people actually operating a business without actually owning any land, which is something that I haven't heard of much, and I really enjoyed it and really liked hearing his side of the story. Look, this is an incredible journey, and I definitely think you should check out and have a bit of a deeper dive into his Instagram account. You will get a few laughs, I certainly do, and definitely check out their website and see what they're doing there over at The Food Farm. One last thing before we do kick off on this episode, I did want to say a massive thank you to this episode's sponsor, which is Roger Hill. Roger has been involved with the podcast since the very start and has helped us really, I suppose, helped me get this going. So thank you, Roger. Greatly appreciate the support that you have given so far. And if you are ever wanting any bit of advice or want to pick someone's brain about northern agriculture, Roger is definitely your man. So be sure to sling him a call. He loves it, doesn't mind a yarn. And yeah, thank you very much. Cheers. Tim, thank you very much for jumping on the Place to Call Home podcast. Before we get too far ahead, can you tell us a bit more about yourself, where you currently live, and I suppose a bit about what you do?
Yeah, Sam, thanks for having me. I'm on the New South Wales Central Coast, so between Sydney and Newcastle, in the Yarramalong Valley. And my partner, Hannah, and I, we have The Food Farm. And, I'm 31 years old and essentially a first-generation farmer. And Hannah's definitely a first-generation farmer. And, we are regenerative farmers, and I've transitioned from conventional agriculture to doing what we do. And we don't own a farm. We lease a series of farms. We've got 7 under our belt at the moment. And, that'll do for a while, I think. And, it's amazing. We produce grass-fed and finished beef, certified organic fed meat, chickens, and eggs as well, pasteurized eggs, and sell them to the public every single week.
Mate, that is very cool and very, very fascinating. And thank you very much for taking the time and having a yarn to us today. Going back to the start, did you grow up on the land? If you didn't, how are you connected?
So I grew up on a 36-acre farm. It was leased out as a turf farm to a neighbouring property. So I didn't grow up with any agriculture sort of in the family or anything like that, but it did exist around me, and I was definitely like a country boy in a very urban area. There's about 200,000 people on the Central Coast, and we're 20 minutes from the beach, so it's mainly skating and surfing around us, and there's these sort of small agricultural pockets around the Central Coast, and I was always drawn to it, like the thug life. I didn't choose the thug life. The thug life chose me when it comes to farming, you know. Like there was no plan B for me. I was always going to be a farmer.
Mate, so it was definitely earlier on that you came to that decision that life on the land was for you. How did you start that initial journey? Like, what was school like? Did you study agriculture through school? Did you go to to study university? Or what did you do along your journey?
School was awful, to be honest with you. Growing up with like dyslexia and some serious mental health issues and a pretty unstable family, school was tough, and and I didn't fit in being the ag kid in the sort of urban setting. So I ended up in boarding school out in Bathurst. And, you know, I was very privileged to be able to have that opportunity in, you know, on reflection. And so I was surrounded by farmers and surrounded by farming and absolutely like delved 100% into agriculture while I was there. School was still very challenging for me. So I left in year 10 and went to Tokau. And I guess that's when Tokau Agricultural College, and that's when like things started to click. I was finally good at something. I duxed my first year and like I was home kind of thing. And it, the wheels and cogs really started turning in time, and did 2 years there and certificate 3 and a certificate 4 in agriculture. And then I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to go to the UK. And I spent 2 months over there just literally looking at farms. And that was an amazing experience through BBM, which I then became a director of their board for 3 years. And, yeah, so that scholarship then just showed me a whole different world. And I think I was rewarded for my passion finally. And then, you know, there was, again, no option but to be a farmer, and I couldn't think of anything better.
Mate, I just was going to bring it back. I don't mean to highlight it, but it's definitely something. The dyslexia has happened. I've just recently had another guest on for this season, and he had it, and he's got it. And then Lachlan Wiley from the first season talked about overcoming that and working through, and how he's set up a successful butchery business. And it's, I suppose what I'm saying is it's really funny. Like a lot of stories, people overcome challenges and it actually sets them up for later on in life to be successful in business. And it, whether it is dyslexia, whether it is challenges throughout the home, it's really interesting. And it's something I suppose I'm just coming across a theme right now from all the people I've interviewed. Mm.
Yeah, I have absolutely no doubt. Yeah, that's what's made me a practical person. I've been able to always be like super flexible and get around issues, because I would have to, I guess, amalgamate myself and like shapeshift to be better at things. And so, and that's what farming calls for. We have to be so flexible. We have to find solutions to problems that conventionally you cannot fix. And so, yeah, it's a blessing. And then, you know, with other things in my life, it's just urged me to become a better human than what I would have been if I didn't recognize that.
Talking, following on from finishing school in Tokau and that overseas trip, what were you doing over there? You said you were just checking out farms over in the UK, but what was that, and how did you come about that?
Yeah, so BBM scholarships are pretty amazing, to be honest with you. They're about $8,000, and they're literally for you as a young person to go and explore something you're passionate about and just open your horizons, and hopefully that will change your life. And at that age, so that you, it's 21 years and under, so it's incredibly young for someone to then, especially from like a country area or if you're a little bit sheltered, to go overseas and explore. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. So, yeah, just headed to the UK. This was in an age before Facebook and any digital world. So, and I can't believe I can say that. So like networking and stuff was pretty difficult, but I was really lucky. I ended up in the house of a Nuffield scholar, and they were the most incredible farmers. They don't own their farm. They never did. Most people in the UK don't own their farms unless they're, you know, 10th generation lords and mayoresses and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, and that's only a reflection I've had recently, is that they're all just existing on leased land. And anyway, got to just have a look, like literally look around, see the UK, see farming, go and work on farms. I milked the most famous dairy bull in the world at Genus, working in their bull milking facility was just ridiculous. They had 70 bulls all in pens in one shed, and they were all half of them were milked every second day. So you're always milking like 35 bulls, and they'd be milked three times in a day. So you'd walk them out, they'd jump onto the teaser steers, and like it was an epic thing to see all of that. And yeah, and just farming in the UK is so restricted and restrictive with the rules. If you haven't been there, like Australian farmers have it so easy when it comes to like even like dead stock and that sort of thing. If a lamb dies over there, they have to pay to get rid of it because of foot and mouth disease and everything that's happened. And so that is such a beautiful thing in many ways and in the context of animal welfare, because it pushes them to care for absolutely every single life that comes onto that farm, because the cost of it dying is way higher than the cost of, you know, the loss. So if that makes sense, like in Australia, in many respects, we'll drive around paddocks and you do see dead stock as a pretty normal thing. And especially in tough times. However, yeah, in the UK, I just found that there is an overriding sort of push that you need to make sure you care for every single life. And whether in context that's a good thing and we're dragging animals that shouldn't be alive, you know, through unhealthy stages. But, yeah, just you learn so much when you go overseas and see those sorts of things. And we've definitely got it pretty lucky here.
So following on, coming back home, now, what were you up to once you got back from overseas? How did you first start those steps towards that that journey of the food farmer?
Yeah. Well, it started nowhere where we are now. My farming for myself started with actually selling a Christmas tree to Bob Mansfield, who at the time had just finished up with McDonald's Australia, and he was the CEO of Telstra Australia at one stage as well. He owned a farm just 10 minutes from us, and his farm manager had just left. I was so young. I would have been 19 anyway, and it was just this amazing meeting. He had 150 acres that he needed run, and I'd just come back and away it went. I started managing his farm, you know, at 2 days a week or something tiny like that, and yeah, got going in the farm management business, and then worked in the Hunter Valley for a place that had a bit of an aggregation for our Hunter Valley terms and Central Coast terms, and then they had a property on the Central Coast, and I ran their Charolais stud, and very conventional. And then through my contact with Bob, he had some good gear, and I started subleasing that, and then I started contracting. So at one stage I was working with 36 farms around the area, contracting to them, doing pasture improvement, like running field days and all those sorts of things, which was pretty cool.
Can you just touch on that? I think it's an interesting point there, that subleasing the gear and running your own contracting. Is that what you were essentially doing with that? Can you just walk us through the steps of how that came about?
Yeah. So the biggest thing anyone will find with me and with what we've done is that everything is about relationships. Our whole life, being a human being, is about relationships. It's about the relationship with yourself and how good that is, and then that is a replication throughout the world of how good your relationships with other people are. And so I was just lucky to have such a great relationship with Bob. He trusted me. And I was able to sort of come up with a deal where I own no gear. I own a bit of hay gear now and I own a tractor now, but I still lease his equipment. Because if we look around, there are so many overcapitalized farms in Australia with stuff sitting in the shed 9 months of the year. Like hours wise, they do very, very little work for what they're capable of. And it was also a way he could justify purchasing sort of better, more efficient machinery for his farm, because, you know, essentially I was helping pay for it in its own respect by going out and, working it on other properties. So worked really well. It was always a gentleman's agreement. And, you know, of that, and there was a lot of trust, an incredible amount of trust from him in terms of the hours, you know, and I would just tell him what hours we'd done and I'd be invoiced and then I'd pay him for those hours. And, yeah, it was an amazing, amazing opportunity, and it lives on to this day.
That's incredible. I think it's something important, that relationship aspect, especially in agriculture. It's so important, and especially when you're getting young, and I've talked about it previously, it's like, especially at West, if you're looking to either gist or lease, a lot of people will usually do a ring around and find out about you, your reputation, who you are, how did your relationship go with other people. And it's so important to have a good one, because as soon as you burn that bridge, you're just going to have a hard time trying to do anything in rural Australia, I think, because everyone is so well interconnected and everything so much rides off that relationship off the back of that. So flowing on from where you're subcontracting that equipment and you started working on the land and you're working for those properties, what was the next step in your journey then?
I guess I bought some cows along the way and started leasing a couple of little farms. And realistically, we probably only had 20 cows 2 years ago. We're nudging 100 now. So there was a lot of that. Hannah and I then we kind of got a spring in our step, and I met a few good people, and we actually put a syndicate together to buy a farm for us, essentially, and we still do want to do this, but yeah, at the time we had a lot of energy and momentum, and we wanted to build the equivalent of the farm at Byron Bay here on the Central Coast. And we found the people with the money, and we had the idea, and they backed us 100%, and we got the money together for a very specific property. But unfortunately, we were gazumped on the farm, and we've never really found one that suits the, you know, suits since. So we haven't gone down that path, and I am so grateful that it didn't work. At the time, like, it challenged me and pushed me to my absolute edges, because it was so close. You know, it was this epitome of success, bringing all this money together and all these people, but I think it would have broken me. I did not have the skills to have run a business like that at that age. So, you know, it was perfect for us at the time to know that it was possible, but then for it not to come off. And I can only look at it with a positive mindset now after doing a hell of a lot of work on it. but then that was sort of the catalyst of that real shift of, like, what do we want? What aligns with us? And in the mix there, you know, we ran a big open day with the local harvest festival, where we hosted 4,000 people on a farm to dig potatoes, and it was an incredible success. And with the tiny little bit of profit, we bought our first chicken caravan with 150 egg-laying chickens.
So at this stage, you're starting to lease bit of country. So this potato, sorry, long lines when you did the festival and did the potato finding, digging up. Where was that? Was that on a bit of lease country that you were working?
Yeah. It was on a lease farm. Like, we were having to lease that area, and it was a great day. It was definitely one of those moments when you, like, cover someone's farm in cars, where you're like, well, we won't get away with this very often. And so, you know, those big events are, like, really good for the ego, but definitely challenged, you know, the longevity of what we were able to achieve without a DA or anything like that. But, yeah, it was really the catalyst of realising how close we are to Sydney, and, like, the deep thirst for people to connect with agriculture and food and the land, and just to be outside. Like, yeah, we take it for granted. Farmers, although it can be the toughest thing, we are the luckiest people in the world to do what we do, where we do it.
100% agree. And
This episode of A Place to Call Home podcast is brought to you by Roger Hill, who is a rural and regional property valuer based in North and Northwest Queensland. Roger is incredibly passionate about the Australian people, the bush, and keeping the next generation coming through. So be sure to get in touch. You can contact him on 0418 200 0046. Thanks, Roger. You're a legend.
I'm going to bring you back a step there because I want to chat a bit more around that leasing opportunities that you are finding and how do those conversations start with those property owners? And along those same lines, did you have like contracts in place with those property owners to lease their properties?
Yeah, so I guess I was really lucky in many ways because of the contracting. I definitely made this perception that I was a good farmer and making great gains, and I had the ability to do well on people's farms and do good things for them. So that was the catalyst, like people actually seeing my work. And as I said, I was running field days with agronomists and that sort of thing. And I will state, like, all that work was really conventional, and I call it fairy floss work, where I was making farms green and pretty and nice, and I was growing great grass with absolutely no results. As in, there was no payoff, nothing, no one was being fed better, or the landscape wasn't better for it. It was literally just for the human mind making these farms better. And like, no doubt when we're working on pH and, trying to fix some imbalances, it was great work. However, it wasn't fulfilling. But in the area, that gave me a great reputation of doing good things, and most people would like offer me paddocks. And once they know that you've got some cows and you need a place, and a paddock would become free, and you'd get a call, I've got this paddock, or someone would say, oh, I know who's my Bob's moving, do you want that paddock? And yeah, it was just, it's endless opportunities with leasing. I think the most difficult thing I've found is when you start making money off it. So people are much happier when it's a hobby and they see that you're sort of like just building up, but it's become much more difficult now that people can see we're incredibly successful. And some people have a real problem with you making more money off their land than they ever could. And that's fine. Like, that's their problem, not mine. I'll find the paddock where someone appreciates what we're doing. More.
So following on from that, and I felt like you were just about starting that conversation. Where did the idea of the food farm come around? Was it following on from that potato festival, and did it grow from there, or where does it initially come from?
Yeah, it is impossible to pinpoint one thing because it's been through so many little stages. Like, well, I did Rural Achiever with Sydney Royal Easter Show, and I found the speech the other day, and that's when like the whole concept came about of building the food farm. I did a speech, for our final day where we're being judged, and my concept was all about like connecting people with a farm. It's like really good to have Instagram and TikTok and all those things, and yes, that's a visceral connection, but like having a place, your podcast, a place to call home, a place for people to say like, yes, this is where my food came from, and touch it and be a part of that landscape is, I guess, the passion that's driven it. And and so, yeah, the potato day, then buying the 150 chooks, and then seeing, all of a sudden you've got 120 eggs a day and you've got to start selling those. And so you start a brand, and things just, we did not have a master plan then. And the Tim and Hannah 3 or 4 years ago looking at us now would be like scratching their heads that we ever pulled it off, I think.
it's a credit to you guys, and it's incredible, I suppose, from an outsider watching in, It looks pretty cool what you're doing, especially that connection piece. Following along, I know we're talking social media here, but that connection and being able to connect people, it's really happening. Like, I love the other day, I forgot what it was, but I think you're out the paddock and a couple of the cows on the lease block got out or something, and you're like, got a call. And I'm like, it was great because that's so real and authentic. What happens? Like, usually in rural places, even up north here, I'll get a call if one of our cows or we've got camels up here end up on the highway. So it was so good to see that, because that's just what happens on the day-to-day basis. And it's great you're sharing that. So you kicked it off. You got your chook caravan. You're ticking along there. Delving into the chook stuff, it's always interested me. How does that business model go, and how do you? And you said you slowly grew from there. And do you still run chooks today?
Yeah. So we're literally just doing the numbers as we speak on doubling our egg laying enterprise. We've definitely been nudged by a lot of people that we need to scale something. At the moment, we have a lot of energy placed, like blanketed over a lot of spots, and we're not necessarily getting like that real drive in one area. And I guess the world's been tapping us on the shoulder saying, do more eggs, because we've literally, like, people are calling us all the time wanting our eggs. We've put our prices up, and they're saying, yep, send them to me. When can you do it? And it's like, okay, cool, this is going to work. So that's great. The chooks are terrific. The eggs are amazing. I can't believe we used to throw eggs out. Because it is such a hard thing. You can't drum up egg business without having eggs. It's unless you're going to like land those eggs in someone's house or restaurant the next week, you can't just go out there and say, I'm going to have these incredible things that you may get in 6 months. Like, it's not that kind of product. You literally need to buy the caravan, buy the chooks. You need to have those eggs laying, those chooks laying, and you need to get those eggs onto people's plates, and you need to go from there and then just like hammer. And it's a daily task. They've got to be collected every day. So we've got two caravans with 500 birds each, and we'd like to get another two caravans to go to 1,000, so 2,000 birds. And we'll probably, at the moment, we're getting around 800 eggs a day, which is pretty good production coming out of winter solstice, and, you know, we've got more daylight hours. Chickens are really sensitive to that. And we sell a really good deal of those, $12 a dozen at the farmers markets. At the moment, we don't have enough at the farmers markets because our wholesale people are sort of taking a lot of them up. And because, we're being told on the radio and the TV that no one's got any money. But from where we're sitting, that is not the case. Like, realistically, the cafes are busier, the markets are busier. That's not translating in society from the people we deal with, I guess.
You think it's something on the lines where people want to be more informed and about their food, where it comes from, and then also they're actually are willing to pay a bit more for good quality food, good quality products, and that's creating that story behind that brand, behind the products, is also a way to sell it. But people want that these days, and they're willing to pay more. And it seems like, have you seen that from what you guys are doing? Because it, and I suppose, how much have you guys played into that?
Yeah. So I've never seen a Lamborghini ad or a, you know, an ad for a top class car. They don't advertise. And that's the thing. Like, it definitely seems like the products that are valued less have to advertise a hell of a lot more. And we're a testament. Like, our growth has virtually been completely natural from a genuine spot. Like, we have spent very, very little money on advertising and getting, you know, the amount of followers and momentum we've got. So that's pretty cool. And that's, yeah, we've got the most expensive chicken in Australia, and we can't grow enough chickens. I sold a $60 meat chicken last week. That's just, people fall over. you know, when you can buy a chicken at Coles for $10 and the bloody thing's cooked, to fathom that I can grow a chicken and then sell it for that is amazing. And it's worth every penny. Like, it absolutely is. Our chicken is amazing and it lives an incredible life. It lives a life that a bird, like I believe, truly deserves. And so when you start telling that authentic story and people educate themselves on their value set, then, yeah, the world's your oyster when it comes to producing food for people.
So going forward from the chicken enterprise that you guys had, what was the next step? You started getting the caravans. Did you started moving in towards beef or any other, or what was your next step from the chooks?
We probably started with beef, to be honest with you. I would have had a few cows, and I think, you know, we killed a couple of steers, and then you're virtually giving it away to your friends and family and that sort of thing. And then I think we went to probably monthly beef boxes, and we were starting to sell a few more eggs around to like a local cafe and that sort of thing. But realistically, the momentum we've got now didn't come about till the second lockdown of COVID. We'd been just incrementally moving in the right direction. I was still managing like three or four farms and fitting the food farm in. Hannah was studying, and we were just sort of patching it along the way. And that one of the great things I think is worth sharing with the chicken enterprise is actually when we scaled to our current two caravans, we were driving through a valley up near Dungog, and I saw a chicken caravan sort of down the back of someone's place and a nesting box sitting next to it. And we just drove in. And we met them and said, you know, what's going on? And the son had that enterprise and it had all collapsed and it was all just sitting there doing nothing. And we said, well, we would love to buy it. We have no money. So would you vendor finance us? And, like, they were so cheap. Now we're looking at, I think we paid $10,000 for the caravan and the nesting box. There's $14,000 worth of nesting boxes. So. What how it worked is we had to pay off the first caravan, $5,000, I think, and we got that on the farm, and he said, well, you start generating some money with that and then you come and pay for the second nesting box and come and get it when you want. And that would have been 9 or maybe even 12 months down the track that we had enough, you know, momentum, and we went and picked it up, and then we built our second caravan. But, like, people giving us those sorts of things and just seeing our passion and love, and then he didn't know us from a bar of soap and letting us drive off into the sunset with his asset, hoping that we pay him, was pretty amazing.
So going back to the boxed beef, I think something I'm quite interested in is along these lines. How did you come about that? And you said you started by literally giving it away to friends and family when you initially did that. How many head were you getting killed, and what was the process of getting those animals killed and boxing those animals?
Yeah, we've been pretty strong in the sentiment of only killing our own stock, and we breed them all ourselves. So that's been a really limiting belief in many ways, but also a strengthening belief in others, because it's our point of difference, especially here on the coast where there's not a great deal of farmers. Who have enough stock to do it. Yeah, so it's been incremental, getting our herd up, trying not to kill all our future breeders because the beef demand's so strong, et cetera, et cetera, and it's a constant demand. And to be honest with you, we killed some pretty rubbish beef early on. It was terrible, mainly because of where our herd started. We were a predominantly European cow base. I was a Charolais fanatic because I'd been indoctrinated into that sort of world and showing cattle and that sort of thing. And those cattle, frankly, aren't engineered to be grass-fed and finished. They are the wrong thing for the job. And realistically, unfortunately, a lot of modern cattle aren't designed to thrive in a paddock. our genetics are all messed up in Australia, in my true opinion. We don't see many good cattle come out of a paddock raw without any help at all now, which is very, very sad. And so, yeah, we would have been killing probably an animal a month, then we went to fortnightly, and then we started doing a farmer's market near us, which was fortnightly, doing some boxes. We were probably delivering the boxes ourselves at some stage. Yeah, and we had no guidance in the business. So, like, no one was there telling us we were doing a great job, do more, do this. Like, we didn't have a mentor, which is a real shame. And now we do have those positive feedback loops. Definitely gives us a lot more energy to back ourselves. So, yeah, it just, as I said, probably gave a lot of beef away. I know we've thrown out a lot of beef from freezing it and, you know, making mistakes and orders not being right. And, yeah, we've worked with some terrific butchers over the time, and we've worked with some really challenging butchers and ones that have really wanted us to go broke as they, you know, pocket a hind quarter here and there. And, yeah, it's been such an incredible journey in that space.
Tim, so where is the food from now? And you said from the COVID, the second round of lockdown, you said it's really skyrocketed. Can you give us a bit of a guide of why that skyrocketed during that period and how it's where you are now?
We've got some great opportunities. Yeah, looking at our analytics, like, I don't mind sharing our numbers a bit because I think we need to celebrate it a little bit more. You know, like, we're doing sort of twice the revenue at our Sydney market that we were when we started and coming out of that lockdown. The market we're in Sydney is really sewn up. Like, they literally, someone has to retire or die for you to get a position there. And we were just lucky that because of COVID, two people, so the meat chicken person and a beef person, decided they didn't want to go to Sydney anymore. And so we got those two opportunities. And then down the track, someone left with eggs. So we had eggs and we're able to take on that opportunity. And then we also did bacon egg rolls because of that. So, yeah, that's been really good. I think the biggest thing with any of these, we live in a world where most people shop every 2 days in urban Australia. So you need to be consistent. That's the big thing. Like, you need to be showing up consistently. Like, monthly boxes just don't cut the mustard anymore. When you're looking at, you know, someone like our cows offering same day delivery on beef in the Sydney CBD, like, that you can't compete with that. From where we're sitting and as a small farmer, but we need to do the absolute best we can to be consistent. And consistency is what has led our business to be where it is, especially with cash flow and that sort of thing. So on the board behind me, you know, we're looking to turn over $1 million this financial year, which is pretty exciting considering we don't own a farm. We've grown this business, you know, from nothing. We have very little debt to run the business as well. Yeah, it comes from a really genuine place. And, yeah, there's a lot of agricultural businesses out there that, you know, don't get that capacity, and they have so many more opportunities than we do. Like, I know people who own a farm who don't generate that much money, and I look at their farms and I'm like, oh my gosh, look at, like, what you could do if you were a bit more uncomfortable. You could do so much. And it's only because we've lived in such a uncomfortable position from not owning anything and having to get to that place that we've pushed so hard.
Mate, thanks for sharing that. And I reckon that paradigm shift is so important for young people out there trying to have a crack. I think, and I know I started this podcast, and very much like, my goal is I still want to own a bit of dirt somewhere. And like, that's my dream. But like along this journey so far, hearing people's stories, hearing what you're saying, hearing, I think Cam mentioned in the first season about his leasing model, taking that from the Americans and using that. There's so much opportunity there by looking outside the box. And that's incredible. $1 million revenue and not owning a bit of dirt. Like that's an incredible story to tell, and it should be shouted off the rooftops from where you guys have come. So thank you very much for that. And I suppose touching on that, and I'll play a bit of devil's advocate, what are some of the benefits, I suppose, following this business model, which we've talked about, but what are some of the cons as well? What are some of the challenges that you've been faced with and had to overcome? And how did you overcome those challenges?
I don't eat you alive. you're everything, right? I'm somewhat of an influencer to the 9,000 people that follow us. I'm still a farmer. I still fix pipes. I still turn up. I'm still an engineer and build chicken caravans. And like as soon and Hannah's everything as well. She's a website designer, a marketing guru, a liaison with couriers. And like you're just, like you think you wear a lot of hats in agriculture and then you go and direct market and you have to wear all the hats that Coles and Woolworths wear and take a hell of a lot of risk with it too. Like we've seen a lot of businesses start and finish in our very short time of doing what we do. And they've spent a hell of a lot of money on their marketing and their campaigns. And I think in many ways, it's a very difficult recipe to get the genuine story over and actually don't come across too shiny. You need to be like that salt of the earth thing. Like, yes, it's really good to have a great website and that, but you can spend a lot of money in the wrong places and then you've got to work really hard to get it back. So, I would agree, Sam, that owning our own farm would be the best and most delightful way to do what we do. It would be just brilliant. However, if we want to stay where we are, that's not the case. So leasing is really difficult. I did a video the other day. I have 36 stakeholders. When I calculate all the neighbours, all the owners, and all the other people, like we lease one farm, 250 acres, and they've got 5 board members. So I've got all of those board members. Then I've got 5 volunteers on that farm as well that like curate all of the lawns and things because it's public space. And so there's 10 people that can like be really annoyed with me if my cows get out or if something's wrong. And then that farm might have 100 people visit it every week because they look at birds. They're called birders. So if one of those people sees a dead animal or, you know, which happens or wire, you know, around an animal, it happens. Like then you've got all those people feeding into you. So it is so difficult. And I'm a recovering people pleaser. So, you know, I have a real problem with making people upset. And so when people are constantly ringing you with an issue with what you've done, that's tough. And it's taken a lot of work, like literally a psychologist once a week for 2 years to get to the state of mind I'm in now where I can say, oh, well, you know, yes, I have a responsibility to deal with that, but it's actually not my problem. They're the one with the problem, but I can have the solution to it. I don't need to take that problem on. And other things, oh, gosh, restaurants not paying you. Like, you know, sometimes when other businesses are doing it just as tough as you or, you know, they don't respect money the same way you do, yeah, it can be really difficult, but it's not a personal thing. They're just, you know, running from their passion. So, yes, and there's so many challenges in doing what we do, and I could go on with them, but they're definitely the things that have grown us into better people.
Thanks, Tib. Thanks for sharing that. And thanks, honestly, you've been incredible so far with your honesty in this chat, and I greatly appreciate it. It's it's something that I've really enjoyed with people, and making sure curating people that will have a yarn and be a bit open and honest, because I believe that's the only way we can learn off each other is by telling the truth and being just upfront about what's going on in each other's businesses, because that way then you can learn. You can learn from your failures and learn from their achievements and the successes. But focusing on you and you guys, what you're up to, what's next? Like, where do you see yourself in next year, 5 years, 10 years?
Like if we keep on the momentum we were doing with Farm Owners Academy, we learned to build a big, hairy, audacious goal. That goal was set for 10 years' time, and I dare say we'll reach it in 5 years' time. So, you know, like the food farm will have a base on the Central Coast. It'll have a cafe or restaurant, an open butchery where people can see that happening, obviously the farming, intimate, like I really, in the next 12 months, I really want to have sort of intimate on-farm experiences where people can actually come and kill their own chickens. So they'll like stay the night, the afternoon they arrive, we'll go and process a chicken, and then they'll be able to eat that the next night and like, you know, really show what it's about if people want to. Otherwise they can have, you know, a romantic nude hot bath out in the paddock. So I think like one of the things I live by is that cows don't have wallets, humans do. So the thing with agriculture is we are so, so detached, or many people are detached from human beings. And again, they are the ones with wallets. So realistically, and I'm not driven by money at all. I probably sound like this savage person who has the most expensive chicken and only wants to be near people because they have money. But I think something that Hannah's really brought to my life is like valuing ourselves and valuing what we do. And farmers innately undervalue themselves. How many farmers do you know that go to the shops and buy the cheapest food and then complain that they're not being paid enough? And it's like, we're a part of the problem. Like, what kind of paradigm is that? Like, you are in this ever-churning circle saying, I don't get enough money. I'm not going to pay that bloody farmer that much for celery. He's going to be off his head. Like, it doesn't make any sense at all. So, like, if farmers want to be valued more, we need to value ourselves first. And then that momentum will grow. So, for me, it's making high-value opportunities on farms. And then, yeah, hopefully, so my mum still owns that 36 acres that I grew up on, and, you know, I'd love to buy that off her at some stage. And, you know, it won't be sort of a clean succession sort of deal. It will have to be, you know, a financial purchase for us to do that, but that is an opportunity, and I hope that comes off down the track. And then we'll start here on the Central Coast, and then I really do hope we build another one in Australia somewhere too.
You've mentioned them a couple of times, but I do ask this question, I suppose, what type of schools have you been involved with that have really been standouts to you? And you have mentioned Farm Owners Academy already. Are there any others, or have they been the biggest influence so far along your journey?
Different influences. Like, I've done RCS, which was amazing in terms of that technical side of things, and I really should go and do it again. Now that I've got sort of the mindset I do, I was definitely like that course was the gateway drug of getting to where I am. And then I've done holistic management as well, which was another like great course. I'll be honest, Sam, my psychologist is the best person I have in my tool belt. That's fundamentally, you know, where we perform from is our minds and our hearts. And if we don't have them aligned and right, we're not going anywhere. And rural and like men in general, but men in rural Australia, like we have talk about a pandemic. And anyone in rural Australia, like mental anguish and pain is, you know, ruining the landscape, literally, because our farms are a direct reflection of our minds. And, you know, we spend a lot of time in agriculture killing a hell of a lot of stuff instead of making it thrive and making it beautiful. And if that's what's being reflected to us constantly, we end up thinking the same about ourselves. So, yeah, I would say seeing my psychologist and psychotherapist and getting around good people like that, and we've obviously got our incredible business coach through the Platinum Mastermind program, and but also a mindset coach through Farm Owners, and just also being a part of a group of other farmers, you know, who I can pick up the phone to and have a good, sturdy conversation about money, life, and, you know, all things in between is pretty cool.
I think that's so important. And I'm passionate about rural mental health. Like, you know, you grow up in the bush and stuff like that. I think, especially around, like, I grew up with a lot of tough men, like, you know, like you'd call them tough, and they wouldn't say much. They wouldn't talk about stuff. And it was just that whole paradigm shift of actually starting to open up and have a conversation with someone could save a life. And it's so important, because, like you said, it's such a bad thing that's going on with rural mental health, and the suicide rate in Australia, in rural Australia, in agricultural industry is way too high. We're losing way too many people, and, like, it's great to hear that. And I think a paradigm shift needs to happen with people, because, like I know for me, I do a workout for not to get strong, but for mentally get it out. And I have someone I speak to as well. And like I meditate, I yoga, I do all these things. And it's not because I'm like almost like a Byron Bay hippie. It's not because of that. It's because I know it makes me a better person, so I can face the day, and makes me a better father. And I think it's so important to highlight those things and maybe be a little bit more selfish, because you've got to look after yourself to ensure that you are there for the future. Yeah.
Yeah. I think one thing another reflection on agriculture as well is we're often only put into, you know, action mode when there is a problem.
Yeah.
And, to anyone listening to this, you should go and see someone before there's a problem. If, you know, like that shouldn't always be the catalyst to get good people around you to help you. It's about, you know, building those good foundations for when you do have a problem, you're much better off, you know, able to sort of deal with those a lot easier. We're often always waiting to be in the disaster to fix it, instead of just trying to be ready for it if it ever does come.
Tim, I believe mentors play such a huge part in people's journey. And have you had many along your journey that's helped you so far? You have mentioned a couple, but do you have any others that you haven't mentioned?
In some ways, I've learned more off the people that weren't my mentors. I guess the people that have, you know, hurt us or, you know, affected us in negative ways. I've learned a lot more from them necessarily than the people who've, you know, haven't been all that lucky to get people to really put us under their wing. But obviously, being an hour from Sydney and farming here is actually super isolating. I'll be honest, there's not many farmers around to, you know, listen to or hear from, but definitely Bob, who I initially mentioned, you know, he's been a really amazing person to be around, and someone who's, you know, got a great money mindset and an ability to see things from a different place. So, yeah, I've definitely been incredibly lucky to have him in my life, and, there's definitely not sort of one person in agriculture either. I think I've been very lucky to have a whole lot of people that I've pulled little parts of, you know, what I like from them and what they do, and then bring that all together, which has been, you know, lovely. I'm just a jigsaw.
I like that. Tim, lastly, what is the one piece of advice you wish you had at the start of your journey?
I think it'll be okay. And like there literally is always something better. Even in the roughest of times, but also when things are going really well, like there'll be an even better thing coming. There's no end to that. It's so exciting. Like being in business is the most exciting roller coaster you'll ever ride. And you know, enjoy that journey, I guess, little Tim. But I guess from a practical sense, it probably would have been employ people earlier and value myself. I worked way too hard and didn't have a holiday and when I was younger, and I wish I had sort of just flexed that muscle a little bit more and made things a bit more autonomous rather than just putting my head down and being selfish with my time. So I think, get the right people in your team as early as possible to help you grow so you don't burn yourself.
Yeah. Tim, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. It's been a cracker of a conversation. I've gotten so much out of this. So thank you very much for jumping on board and, hopefully chat to you soon.
Thanks so much, Sam.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of A Place to Call Home podcast. If you have, please share it with some friends and family. It's the best way to get the word out there about what we're doing. And if you've got a few minutes, if you can throw us a rating, that would be much appreciated as well. Anyway, for today's quote, I want to leave you with one from Maya Corrigan. And I think it fits in pretty nicely with Tim's story. And it says, "You are what you eat and read." Have a great day.